Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy, and once again, we are back with a special edition. This time, I'm talking to Pat Colaluri. We are celebrating the 20th anniversary of Headstrong, one of the foundational organizations of the lacrosse community, one that I am very proud to have been a member of, or a supporter of is probably a better term for it, at the outset of my time at Inside Lacrosse, and certainly really happy to be joined by you, Pat, and talk about the celebration of this milestone. Obviously, it carries with it a lot of sadness, but at the same time, given the legacy that you guys have been able to build on top of what Nick established, also certainly a moment for reflection and for pride. But to begin, for listeners that are unfamiliar with Headstrong, can you just give a little bit of the background in terms of your brother Nick, how it started and what you guys have accomplished over the last 20 years?
Sure, of course. My younger sibling, Nick, was a student athlete at Hofstra University back in 2005. He was terminally diagnosed with this aggressive form of cancer. He was just 19 years old. His platform as a student athlete was one that he leaned into. He was forced to withdraw from school in the blink of an eye. You know, everything that he knew changed. Our family was dealt this roller coaster ride of a situation. Nick was diagnosed with something called mature B-cell non-Hodgkin's lymphoma at an aggressive stage. The crazy part about it was he didn't present symptoms in the traditional sense. And the only thing that would have lent into that something wasn't right was a stuffy right nostril. And it was a tonsillectomy that revealed his cancer. And, Nick was forced to withdraw from school, right? Virtual learning wasn't an option. He came home. What followed was 14 months of really hellish, intensive treatments that sadly were unsuccessful, and it really pushed our family to the brink. But all the while, Nick embraced that platform as a student athlete, recognized that, he had a community behind him, and they certainly came out in the way of droves of support. And I think about that a lot because it's what makes lacrosse and our community so special. I think about that a lot because when Nick was going through his difficult times and our family was drowning, it was the lacrosse community that really put us on their shoulders. And it started out with calls and care packages and just different things of providing introductions to people that they thought could be helpful. And I remember very specifically Mike Murphy, who at the time was coaching at Haverford College, brokering an introduction to one of his players who was going through Hodgkin's lymphoma at the same time. And I think that really, really alleviated a lot of my brother Nick's concerns in way of starting treatment. I also think that for Nick, he was someone that had that validation, right? If there was one thing that really happened was before people sent contributions via GoFundMe platforms, it was a very personalized reach out. And I think the close-knit nature of our sport and how interconnected we all are just gave way to just an amazing thing in that it takes the worst of situations to bring out the absolute best in people. And that was exactly what we at the organization today try to bestow on families. You see, Nick was a kid that lived in his vision. I think very early on, he understood that this happened to him for a reason, or at least that was his belief set. And on the other side of that, because of that sense of community behind him and just who he was in way of his DNA as an athlete, I think he was looking to prove others wrong, right? When coaches were possibly overlooking a 5'7", 165-pound kid that was, dynamo on a lacrosse field, but from a player standpoint didn't check all the physical prerequisites, his motor and his drive and his leadership certainly did, and it turned heads. Joe Amplo talks about it today. It's just like sometimes his biggest lesson that he learned was not to underestimate, what players are capable of. As Nick was essentially a walk-on his freshman year and started all 17 games. And so what was interesting was that given Nick's diagnosis, knowing what we know and giving the staging, the doctors would have indicated that he would have lived 3 to 4 months. And he battled relentlessly for 14. And there were things that Nick did in a hospital room, or I should say from a hospital room, that were really tangible things. And he was concerned for the well-being of our family. And he had this vantage point of being 19 years old and having a community behind him. And he saw a lot of people that needed a teammate. and he wanted to address the shortcomings. He saw the measures and the lengths of families and the challenges that they were dealing with. And very early into his cancer fight, he started putting pen to pad and really trying to create tangible solutions. And those things started with organizing fundraisers to finance chair beds for caregivers. It was the renovation of a patient services room. It was working with Drexel's engineering students to create multi-entertainment units. It was working with Philadelphia area restaurant groups to bring in meals to alleviate that emotional duress and the comforts of a home-cooked meal and a sliver of normalcy. He was somebody that began peer mentoring other patients. And in the throes of his cancer fight, he leaned into his situation and he began welcoming cameras and reporters and you know, giving interviews about his specific disease and the challenges that his family was living. And Inside Lacrosse was one of those media outlets. And we've always considered you all true teammates in the fight. Today, this organization is one that walks hand in hand, a coach, if you will, a teammate, if you will. The organization today doesn't exist to cure diseases, but rather walk alongside of families in their fight, giving them access to care, alleviating all burdens in way of financial relief and emotional coaching, and most notably Nick's House, which provides complimentary accommodations, lodging, and services to families that have to relocate in pursuit of treatment. And ironically, as we're doing this interview, today is the second birthday or anniversary of our Nick's House Boston location. So we have two Nick's Houses, which provide 6,000 nights of complimentary housing at no expense to the families. And we're getting ready to embark on an expansion to North Carolina with our third. So 20 years, 40,000 families served, $40 million distributed in way of relief and services, and soon to be three Nick's Houses fully occupied and really green lighting the patient journey so that families can go the distance. And that's exactly the promise that we made to Nick 20 years ago and now carry forward as his legacy.
And one of the things about the 20-year anniversary celebration is the reflection on evolution. You have kind of segmented the history of Headstrong into two parts with the eye toward the third. How are you thinking about what the next step is and looks and feels like?
You know, I think the next chapter of Headstrong is really exciting. And I think a lot of it hinges on the platform that athletes have today and just what so many are focused on in way of what's completing them as student athletes, the entire, the whole picture, right? It's all too often that we focus on athletic accolades, right? And it's something where we're chasing those opportunities. We're chasing exposure. We're chasing commitments. We're chasing, you know, pushing ourselves to the highest levels of our sport and beyond. I think today the platform of a student athlete, whether they're a lacrosse player or a volleyball player, is broad and it's, you know, extensive. And we've seen this collective of young people that are really intrinsically motivated by making a difference in using their platform for good, right? Purposeful engagement, servant leadership, you know. And I think what's resonating with them today is the authenticity of our mission. What Headstrong's doing is creating tangible solutions to real world and real life problems in real time. And I think that that is something that people are seeing. I think the days of throwing money to the ether and trying to just, you know, again, people want to be connected to their donor dollars, right? And I think one of the most amazing things that Nick embraced years ago was that he was a 19-year-old kid, and you're never too young to make a difference. And so a lot of the programming that Headstrong is building, such as like our Attack Cancer campaign, which has just been a viral moment for the organization after 20 years of continued creating things that people feel a sense of connection to, right? And I think that starts with like understanding our audience, right? I think that not only did we as an organization and as a family walk in the shoes of the people we serve, so we understand their plight with an empathetic and compassionate arm. But on the flip side of that coin, we also understand the dynamics of athletes, right? We've worked alongside and hand in hand with athletes for two decades plus. And, You know, this next chapter is one that's designed to educate and inspire and really provide a foundational layer for people to stand on, especially when cancer hits home. And cancer's hitting our sport in a big way, man. Between players, between coaches, between their partners and spouses, between players' families and loved ones. And I can honestly say that while not everybody we serve is a lacrosse player, anytime there is, man, we're in the trenches. And my heart is certainly with all of them. And I think that level of connectivity that was bestowed on us 20 years ago is exactly the position in which we play today. And I think people feel a strong sense of connection. So to your point about next chapter, you know, we're seeing a lot of engagement outside of sport, which is huge. But we also have the responsibility to educate the next generation. Let's face it, after 20 years, there are kids playing this sport and even those entering the college ranks who weren't even born when Nick was sick. But to know that so many of them feel so passionately about our mission, there are athletes that are proudly wearing Nick's number on the field with purpose. Players like Will Schaller at Maryland, players like Will Linko at Flagler that are continuing to just like beat the drum. And that 27 means so much to so many. And that for us is so beautiful. And, you know, for us as a family, I think it starts with a commitment. I know me as an older brother, you know, deep down inside, you know, yeah, our family was changed forever. I think about all the time, like what Nick, you know, why Nick was so motivated to create Headstrong. And I think that it's twofold. He saw a gap in care that he could leverage his community to support. And he also wanted to secure the emotional well-being of his family, knowing that he wasn't going to be here. And in that, there's beautiful. It's a beautiful thing. It's unconditional love. And so me, you know, I've always led by a sense of like, yes, yeah, selfishly, I don't want my brother to be forgotten. He was a remarkable person, you know, and we try to bestow who Nick was and how he lived on everybody that we've ever came into contact with.
It's particularly poignant. I don't think you know this. Not very many people do. So about 2 years and 2 days ago or so, I got word that my older brother, who's 10 years older than me, had gotten diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and he died last September. And as you just described, it has effects on families and dynamics and how you regard life in ways that nothing else can. You know, it's a truly formative experience. And I think that, you know, having gone through that and, you know, he was the father of three and a husband of, you know, upwards of 25 years and seeing how they each, you know, responded and, you know, came together as a family and everything that goes along with that. While there is little dispute that it's the worst thing in the world in many, many ways, it also is a disease that brings out a lot of the best qualities in people and their lives. And to then transpose that onto the life of a 19-year-old and hear you describe his motivation from the standpoint of, you know, his desire to serve and his desire to do what he could in order to leave his family in the most, I guess for lack of a better way of putting it, secure emotional position as possible. It's so noble and it's so selfless. And again, you know, having gone through it pretty closely myself, pretty recently, it's reframed the work that you guys have done. And, you know, I just wanted to take the opportunity to kind of personally say, you know, how much, you know, my own understanding, appreciation and respect and regard for the way in which you've made it your life's work, has been focused on it. So I just wanted to include that in this conversation.
I really appreciate you being vulnerable with me, man. It's okay to be vulnerable, and I'm so sorry about your brother. You know, for me, being a brother, the best title of my life, for the exception of being a husband and a dad. It's on all my emails, right? Chief Development Officer and Nick's brother. And, you know, to me, I get this opportunity to be the keeper of the stories, the teller of the stories. There's so many people that'll share with me their relationship with Nick. And I hope for you the same. You know, I'm sorry that you lost your brother, and it's, you know, one of the more challenging things to watch somebody that you love unconditionally going through something and you can't change it for them, right? My mom says that all the time. It was probably the hardest thing about going through cancer as a family. And to your point, though, I never thought that our family was more aligned. I look back on that situation, as desperate as it was, and, you know, at the time I was coming out of college, I didn't realize just how financially paralyzed my family was. Close to $1 million in medical debt. I remember my mom and dad having to sell a house we had down the Delaware beaches. It was our childhood summer home. And it was just an attempt to free up viable income. And I remember my dad selling a Harley Davidson. And it was just like, you know, almost succumbing in and of itself, what was happening. And we didn't understand at the time, Terry, that it's the leading cause of personal bankruptcy and home foreclosure in the United States. I think that the statistic that we became, the one thing that I lean on all the time is that we refused, and Nick refused, to be a victim of it, even though, you know, maybe that was our starting point, you know. We found ourselves in the end of Nick's life. There were two really interesting things that put a gleaming spotlight on what we do today. And the first thing was, we met a family living out of the parking garage of their hospital. And, you know, ironically, we're from Charlottesville, Virginia, and that's where the NCAA championships is going on this year, right? And you know, my dad ended up welcoming this family into our home during our own health crisis, just because we had an available bedroom. Desperate times call for desperate measures. We found ourselves in Washington, D.C. at the National Institute of Health at the end of Nick's life. We were given 1 hour to make that decision. Would we continue forward? And Nick wanted to fight on, and that was our promise. And we were walloped financially, but tomorrow wasn't guaranteed. And, you know, I think when you stare down the scope of a shelf life or a terminal diagnosis, and, you know, there is some beauty in that, because you start savoring the moments. You know, you're not thinking for the future. So you're living in the present, and there's something really beautiful about that. And maybe this idea about no regrets, you know, we spend our lives planning for an uncertain future. The one thing that we do at Headstrong today is, you know, be present. We show up. We show up for people, you know, in the thick of their cancer fight, whether that's accompanying somebody to chemotherapy, or whether that's showing up to take them out to dinner, or whether that's delivering an experience for them that makes them smile, or whether that's, like I said, welcoming them to Boston to undergo a clinical trial that hopefully changes their outcome. It's all the phone calls. And there's this other side of Headstrong which doesn't get talked enough about, and that's the grief side of things, right? When somebody loses a loved one, Headstrong becomes their grief system. You know, we become a vessel to be able to create opportunities for them to memorialize loved ones, you know, to try to help their hardest days be a little bit brighter. And so, you know, it's this amazing system that we've built and that we're scaling that really plays such a pivotal role. And, you know, I appreciate you sharing about your brother. I certainly didn't know him, but knowing you and the type of person that you are, because for those who don't know, Terry is by far probably one of the biggest contributors to our sport, who just plays such a behind-the-scenes role and has so many incredible relationships. And so I can only imagine what a dynamic person your brother was. You know, in addition to your brother, I'm thinking about Sam Nice. You know, Sam Nice was a student athlete that I met a year and a half ago. He was a lacrosse player at Penn College of Technology. And just last week, I sadly had to attend his memorial service. And for a year and a half, he and I worked together. And this was a young man that literally had the sport taken from him instantly, but it also, because of his diagnosis, he had everything else taken. His independence, they took his driver's license. You know, he wasn't able to continue on with schooling. So this is a, you know, a 20-year-old kid that's just going through things, and he had the opportunity to be woven into our Mustache Madness campaign last year. And I'll tell you, at the end of his life, He proudly beat the headstrong drum sharing his story, just like Nick did. And, you know, I remember, like, the one thing that he wanted to do more than anything was to build a motocross bike with his dad. And his mother, the day he passed, sent me a picture of the completed bike, and it was customized for Headstrong. And I just, when I think about that, I left his memorial service, and forgive me, I get emotional with it because it's that real. I walked out of that memorial service and I said, this kid believes in us. And I'm of a mindset that, like, had it not been for Nick, we wouldn't have had the opportunity to do what we do, which we consider to be the privilege of a lifetime, man.
And I think that story goes a long way toward, and there are a lot of other stories that go a long way toward illustrating the connective tissue between lacrosse, both as a game and a sport, and a calling might be too strong of a word, but certainly, you know, it was the focal point of Nick's goal structure in terms of, you know, how you described his kind of drive to make the team at Hofstra and get on the field and be a contributor, and then how that has become the cornerstone of Headstrong as a brand, and how you guys have, you know, built. And I think for so many, the entry point into the organization is the shoelaces. And it's funny to hear your comment about how a lot of college lacrosse players weren't even alive when Nick was playing, and yet so many of them have worn those shoelaces. How do you think about the kind of continued ebb and flow of how the lacrosse community has embraced Headstrong, and how you would like it continue, how you would like to see it continue as you take the next step?
I think, you know, the presence that we have in the sport is one of sincerity and authenticity, where so many people that from early on became lead blockers for us, right? I remember Tony Seaman calling me down to Towson, and shortly after Nick passed, and there was a talks about bringing to life a fall scrimmage that could support Headstrong. I remember taking a ride down to Towson, and he sat me in his office, and, you know, he shared with me his fundraising model. People like Bob Schillinglaw, who, when we launched Mustache Madness, you know, took us by the bootstraps and, you know, supported it wholeheartedly.
He himself very loyal to the mustache look.
Yeah. People like Dave Cottle and Dave Petromala, people like Fred Acey, you know, that really embraced Headstrong, just providing a platform for my mother to speak, to inspire, and to really, you know, now I think about today, and it's like people like, you know, Ryan Wellner and Sean Woods and J.B. Clark and all these wonderful people with the IMLCA that, like, have just, you know, Headstrong is part of who they are, you know. And to me, whether it's, you know, a guy like Sean Nadlin, or whether it's a guy like John Crawley, or somebody like Paul Richards, or, you know, I can proudly say that Headstrong is part of them, and they're a teammate to the organization. And so this organization is personal. You mentioned the lime green shoelaces, right? So many teams still integrate that into their uniform. Tufts University has made lime green Headstrong shoelaces part of their uniform since 2007. And, you know, when I think about the impetus of it, the creation of the laces, Nick's hospital room looked out onto the campus of the University of Pennsylvania. He was watching student athletes taking the field and never once becoming resentful. But, like, as he looked down on the floor and saw his shoes, he thought for a moment and said, wow, you know, shoelaces are universal. If they're lime green, they're going to spark conversation. People are going to want to know why they're lime green. And in a moment, it's the first thing that athletes do before they take the field, right? That moment of clarity where they lace up their cleats. It's a statement. And I'll forever remember Chris Bates and what he did when he was at Drexel University shortly after Nick passed. He, you know, they wore the shoelaces against University of Virginia and beat them. And Virginia was the defending national champions at the time. And it was kind of a David and Goliath matchup. And, you know, the Drexel Dragons were the first team to wear Headstrong shoelaces. And I oftentimes say that the commentary from that game kind of sparked the movement. And, you know, something as inexpensive as shoelaces, and that was what Nick was about, trying to find a way that anybody could support the cause, right? Whether you had $5 or whether you had $500,000, like, it was a matter of, like, what's a low-hanging fruit that people can feel a connectivity to? So when I see athletes still to this day, and you take a look at it, these lime green shoelaces mean a lot to a lot of people. I mean, take a look at Princeton University, right? You know, they have competed the last 2 years proudly wearing Headstrong shoelaces. And anchoring that is a wonderful cause ambassador in Chad Palumbo. And so I think, like, for many of them, you know, and you mentioned about where the next chapter of Headstrong goes with, you know, young people, it's those who are waving the flag and beating the drum in this next generation. And it starts with shoelaces, and it evolves with our Attack Cancer campaign, which is a wonderful fundraiser that is year-round, and it's versatile to other sports, but it's got really strong traction in men's and women's lacrosse, and it's really giving athletes a viable campaign to that aligns to their seasons, right? Whether it's in the spring or in the fall or in the summer, it's something that allows them to, you know, to advance our mission. It allows us to turn a season into solidarity. You know, it allows them to make an impact that they can see. It's simple, right? And it's tangible. So, you know, again, product is definitely something that was defining of Headstrong in formative years. And the Inside Lacrosse events were pivotal in that, right? I think about, like,
with the Nets.
Green Nets at the Meadowlands, and, you know, right?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
I could go back, and I have a picture in our conference room from that game, and the officials were wearing lime green with stripes. And, you know, I think that, too, for people that are influencers today, that are coaches, you know, an opportunity to inspire your players, you know, give them the backstory on a young man that that made the most of very little, right? I stopped measuring life by how long you're here, but rather what you do while you're here. Nick was a prime example of that, right? And for so many of these programs that are rocked by cancer, there was a family down in Bradenton, Florida. His father taught himself how to play lacrosse just so he could have a catch with his son because he wasn't well enough to go to games. We lost that man back in November. His dying wish was to be buried and cremated with a Headstrong bracelet on. I mean, when you think about that, I get chills when I talk about it, but it's real. And Headstrong's a cause that people obviously have been behind for years, but this next generation of athlete is going to help us take this to a whole nother level. And we're so excited to do that with you.
One of the places that my mind goes is how right here and right now this is. And we're recording this on Friday early afternoon, May 1st. And about 3 hours ago, I edited a Big East semifinal game story by Christian Sweezy, in which he talked about how the Hoyas warmed up wearing t-shirts to acknowledge James Coretta, who was diagnosed within the last couple of weeks. And it, for me, it's just a acknowledgement of the fact that because of the thief in the night nature of this disease, you never know when it's lurking around the corner and who is going to be the next affected by it. And I think that's why the omnipresence of Headstrong within the community is so useful, because you're typically, you know, at most 1 degree of separation away from a relationship.
No, I appreciate you saying that about us, and most importantly, you know, our hearts are certainly standing with the Coretta family. I'm proud to share with you that literally before our, you know, our pod here, James and I, we've been working together since his diagnosis. And that for me is, that just speaks to the authenticity of the organization. James is remarkable. His outlook is incredible. We're standing alongside of the Coretta family and the Georgetown family. And, you know, I think that, and it comes with time, but I can point to almost so many programs, and I not only have a story that intersects with them, but something positive that we've done together for someone within their ecosystem, whether that was a bus driver at UMass or whether that was, you know, a student athlete that, you know, was plugged into us through an introduction made by a coach, or whether it was a lacrosse player like James. And just a couple weeks ago when James was first diagnosed, I had actually received a phone call from his college roommate. And he was like, "Hey, I never thought I'd have to make this phone call." And within 10 minutes, you know, James and I were underway developing a relationship forward and putting a plan in place alongside of his family. And, you know, there's a bunch of student athletes across Division I, II, and III that are in the thick of their fight. There's a young man that plays for Flagler. He's 21 years old. His name is Luke Burton. And you'll notice that Flagler, you know, they just won their respective conference. They're advancing to the postseason. And number 26, Luke Flagler, they carry that jersey into battle each game, and they're wearing lime green shoelaces. You know, there's a couple of other players as well who we're working with that are just, you know, going through it at all different places in their journey. But the one thing that I'm definitely proud to say is that we're standing with each and every one of them. And like I said, I appreciate you recognizing, because I think one of the most beautiful things about team, especially a team navigating adversity, is the togetherness that it brokers. And it's funny because I said to James, I said, you know, look, it is May. There is a tension on our sport. My advice is never lose sight of the fact that you're at the helm of the dialogue, and lean in. And I think others will benefit. And so, like I said, still bestowing the lessons that Nick taught me, and bestowing that on the brotherhood for sure.
One of the points you mentioned is the prospect of expansion to North Carolina and the ability to serve more families. Can you speak a little bit more directly toward that initiative and where it sits?
Sure. So, you know, as I shared earlier in the conversation, our family was relocated to Washington, D.C., and the circumstances were dire. We didn't know where we were going to stay. We were given a 1 hour chance to make the decision of continuing forward. And we were in Philadelphia, as you know, Ter. So it was, how quickly can you get to D.C.? We didn't know where we were going to stay. We didn't know for how long. It wasn't like we could make a phone call and, you know, and coordinate something. So we're talking 20 years ago. But the reality is that 40% of the cancer population has to travel for their treatment. 50% of the cancer journey is spent in transit. Okay, these are just facts. You know, the reality is that for so many families, the feasibility factor of a relocation, it's just not in the cards. So what you see often is about 30% of the cancer community or population forgoing treatment or compromising best care. So for us, I think what we understood was, while Nick did not have a favorable outcome, we never had regret. And for far too many people that we've lost, it's instant. Someone loses a loved one, and the first thing they say is, man, what if we would have went to Houston? Or what if we went to, you know, New York? Or what if we went to Boston? Like, would that have saved our loved one? We wanted to bestow that on people, to give families that opportunity, right? To have no regrets, to endure. That was the promise that we made to Nick. And so back in 2011, after my parents became financially whole, my mom and dad remortgaged their own home to open up what became our first Nick's House. And when I questioned them on it, they said, you know, we'd live in a box if we could have our son back. That was the level of commitment. And in addition to that, for all these years, we have grown Nick's House in Philadelphia. We now have an 8-family home right off campus at Swarthmore College. 2 years ago, we expanded with an 8-family home in Brookline, Massachusetts, just a stone's throw from BC and BU. Those homes operate at 100% occupancy all the time, and it's not just a roof over one's head, it's a community it's services, it's infrastructure, it's fitness center, it's working stations, it's virtual classrooms, it's being woven into the fabric, because the average family that stays with us is 6 to 8 weeks on average. They're relieved of about $15,000 in out-of-pocket expenses. And now the expansion into North Carolina is pivotal. You know, the Duke Cancer Center, alongside of UNC Health, are bringing together a 500-room children's hospital. And while the majority of people that we serve, we kind of counterbalance. We don't say that, you know, we're not a pediatric-specific organization. In fact, the greater majority of the people we serve are probably 18 to 65. You know, that's kind of indicative of 99% of the cancer population. And so, you know, you're dealing with people that are, you know, young people, 18 to 40 years old. It's the largest growth segment in way of cancer occurrence in the United States. And so it's a lot of folks that have either exhausted their resources locally, treatment has been unsuccessful, and now they have to relocate in an advanced or clinical nature. And so Durham is a key destination for specialized treatment, and there's an overarching need. And so it's our responsibility as an organization to deliver the solution of Nick's House and then continue forward. We plan over the next 20 years to open up another 4 to 5 Nick's Houses. That is kind of the game plan. You know, again, the only way that that gets done is through an amazing stable of support and community. And that kind of leads us up to, you know, today. We are currently going through the real estate process. We're vetting the real estate. The homes themselves typically have to be spatial. They have to be, close in proximity, and they have to be accessible. The homes themselves are also designed so that the patient lives on site in addition to their care team, because the vast majority of treatments are now moving in the direction of infusing at home. But for our patients, a lot of them are going through either trials or transplants. And so a lot of their treatment is extensively inpatient. Let's just say proton therapy. Proton therapy drives a lot. And with that being said, somebody might be coming in for a leg of treatment. So they're not familiar, or, you know, they're not in a surroundings that's home. So we alleviate not only the burden of the cost associated with the stay, but create the most amazing atmosphere for them to have respite and recovery.
You brought up something there that's really interesting, and it was kind of the first time it's occurred to me, which is how cancer treatment has evolved so much over the course of the last 20 years. Yeah. And the relationship that plays to the nature of your support. How do you describe that? I mean, proton therapy wasn't something that was on the radar when Headstrong became an organization.
Yeah, immunotherapies were in their infancy. In fact, Nick was one of the first adult recipients of what's called the CAR-T infusion, and that was a stem cell transplant. There has been some incredible strides, but ironically, there are more people living with the disease today than ever before, right? So the investment is kind of like in life years, and that's great. Quality of life is certainly important. Quantity is equally as important. But what that's doing is it's keeping people really handcuffed to a lifetime of expense. And when you broker relationships with people, you develop this whole medical team, you're now on a lifetime of unexpected things and high recurrence rates. So I would say, like, proton therapy has been wonderful for certain types of cancers, have really made some big strides. But what's interesting is that we are seeing, unfortunately, a combination of brain, blood, breast, and colon cancer diagnoses across young adults, which is occurring in stage 4 and is chemo resistant. And so it's interesting, because as much as what's gained is as much as what's changed, you know? So I would say, if there's anything, I would say that the treatment journey, especially with proton therapy, that drives a lot of things, because there's not as many locations across the country. You know, there are 14 states without a comprehensive cancer center, which means that, and that was what drove so many people to Boston over the years. I'll give you an example of someone from our beloved La Crosse community who, you remember Sean Fox by any chance?
Of course, yeah.
So Sean was obviously at one point the president of Brine. He was one of the founding members of 3D Lacrosse, and he was living in Boulder, Colorado. And he was diagnosed with brain cancer. Well, you know, in order to receive treatment, he ended up having to go from Boulder, Colorado to Boston. And his family lived in Rhode Island. So he was commuting daily from Rhode Island to Boston and for his treatment. That was what, you know, when a bunch of the boys from Brown Lacrosse had visited Nick's house back during their college years, they were so awakened to what we were looking to do that when the opportunity presented in Boston, it was actually three Brown Lacrosse players that stepped forward, one being Sean Fox's son, that actually helped us to bring it to life. And that to me is like one of the coolest things about, you know, an understanding of who it is and what we do. It's just, wow, you know, these laces that I've worn my whole life, I didn't realize what they've done.
And the way in which they would manifest into a call to action, which I think is the best way to end this conversation, because I'm imagining that there are a lot of folks listening to this who feel inspired and potentially called and want to know what they can do to help. How would you answer that question? What's the best way to help support Headstrong?
Sure. I think that you can learn a lot by, you know, following us on social at HeadstrongFND. You can visit the website headstrong.org. You can explore Attack Cancer right through that website as well if you're a scholastic athlete or a coach. You can get involved with a dedication game. You can pledge a season through Attack Cancer. You can make contributions right through that website as well. To stay at Nick's house, it's about $150 a night is what we denote, right? And so for every $150, we're able to provide a complimentary night for a family. In addition to that, we encourage people to learn more and lean in. We're always interested in learning about what happens in certain communities, right? We know that cancer is prevalent. So if Headstrong is an organization that can be of service to the local community, we're accessible, right? And I think that that localized impact is critical. We have a series of events that range from golf outings to formal events to, as you know, our fall event series, which has been now in its, we're coming up on like 19 years of our fall event series, which this year will take place in like six markets. And we're working through particulars now. But for us, it's like, hey, attend one of those events. You know, oftentimes if there's somebody in somebody's local community navigating cancer, plug us in, right? We always say, plug us in, coach. Let us know how we can help, what we can do. Because I think, you know, being of service is what really moves the needle for Headstrong and really helps people to make a localized impact in their backyard. So we look forward to getting people involved. I'd love to see more teams, especially at the youth level, club level, wearing Headstrong laces, right? You know, lime green has seemed to become a color that so many teams have integrated. And, you know, what's interesting about style of sport, I feel like right now it's a very vanilla type of sport, right? It's, you know, there's not a whole lot of flair. And I know that, you know, you take a look at baseball right now and it reminds me so much of what lacrosse style used to be, right? And I laugh sometimes because I say the shorts get shorter and then right. They get longer, right?
Yep.
And that's how you can tell how style starts to influence our game. But like I said, lime green is something that certainly is timeless in our sport and means a lot. So, Terry, thank you so much for the opportunity and the time. Thank you for sharing your story too. I've learned so much just about you and in this conversation. And I just want to say thank you for being part of Headstrong. You know, thank you for always keeping Nick close to your heart.
Absolutely, my man. Thank you so much for your time. And thank you to all those who listened. Really appreciate the time and attention. If you like what you heard, tell a friend, leave a rating and review, share the podcast, and we'll be back later in the week with more Inside Lacrosse Podcasts.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.